Medicom Medical Publishers produces peer-reviewed reports and highlights on major medical meetings. We bring the Congress to the physician.
Welcome to this podcast brought to you by Medicom Medical Publishers. My name is Dr. Rachel Giles, and I'm the Medical Science Officer at Medicom. In this episode, we cover six presentations from the 18th Congress of ECCO, or the European Crohn's and Colitis Organization, and their annual meeting was held March 1st through 4th, 2023 in Copenhagen, Denmark. Enjoy listening.
Thank you to all the healthcare professionals who have worked so hard to bring us through the current pandemic.
We're going to start off with the Reprevio trial, which was intended to establish whether a treatment with vedolizumab starting shortly after an ileocolonic resection would have a beneficial effect on the recurrence of Crohn's disease. It was a randomized, multi-center, placebo-controlled study that included about 80 postoperative patients who either received a placebo or 300 milligrams of vedolizumab every 8 weeks until week 24, at which time a video-recorded ileocolonoscopy was performed. This was a presentation held by Professor Geert de Haens from the Academic Medical Center at the University of Amsterdam, the Netherlands. And he said, quote, "We included patients who had a somewhat of a high risk for endoscopic recurrence," end quote. The study cohort had a median age of about 36 years, and nearly half the participants were women. The median disease duration was 8 to 9 years. About one-third of the patients had a history of one or more prior resections, and approximately 48%, or half, had previously been treated with TNF antagonists. Professor Geert de Haens said, quote, "Patients in the vedolizumab group had a 77.8% chance of having a lower Rüdiger score than patients in the placebo group, where that was a significant p-value. When evaluating the secondary endpoint of having low or a high risk of recurrence, the likelihood of a low risk was 77% on vedolizumab and 38% for a placebo. Again, highly significant. Importantly, the endoscopic remission was found in about 1 out of 37 versus 18 out of 43 patients in the placebo versus the vedolizumab arms, respectively. So that's roughly the same numbers, and there's 1 versus 18. That's pretty high change. Quote, "Intriguingly, we did not observe a difference in clinical relapse, and we know that the endoscopic lesions precede clinical recurrence by a long time, so that is something you can only study in studies of much longer duration. With regard to safety, no new signals were detected in Reprevio." In his conclusion, Professor de Haens highlighted that starting vedolizumab within 4 weeks of ileocolonic resection is highly effective to reduce incidence and severity of postoperative relapse in patients with increased risk of recurrence. Moving on to the True North trial. So the interim analysis of the Phase 3 True North open-label extension trial evaluated ozanimod in patients with moderate to severely active ulcerative colitis, or UC, on about a 3 years of continuous ozanimod treatment for efficacy and safety over time. This was presented by Professor Silvio Danese at the Vita Salute San Raffaele University in Northern Italy. And he presented the data on 131 open-label extension patients on clinical response after 52 weeks of ozanimod maintenance. At week 46, there was a 95.9% for clinical response, which dropped a bit at 94 weeks to 91.4%. For clinical remission levels, at 46 weeks, it was 72.2%, and at 94 weeks, it dropped a little bit again to 69.1%. For the endoscopic improvement, it went from 77.9% down to 73.3% at 94 weeks. And in the steroid-free remission, it was 70.1% at week 46 versus 67.9% at week 94. As would be expected, the rates of the non-responder imputation analysis were lower, with the clinical response in 71.0% and 56.5% at weeks 46 and 94 respectively, and the steroid-free remission also dropped a bit from 51.9% to 42% in those patients at those time points. What Professor Danese commented on was that, quote, "Looking at the course for mean partial Mayo score, you see that from the induction there's a nice drop, and then through the maintenance and the open-label extension periods, the course pretty much remains flat. So it means that ozanimod keeps working." The safety analysis included 433.9 patient years of ozanimod exposure. The treatment-emergent adverse events led to discontinuation in only 6.1%, or 8 patients. Within that group of the most frequent treatment-emergent adverse events, it was lymphopenia, arthralgia, COVID-19, and hypertension were the most common. Professor Denese said, quote, "When you look at the infection rates, you can see that the events are very rare, and there have only been 7 cases of herpes zoster, and when you look at cancer, there have been almost no cases reported." He indicated that no safety signals were observed during the long-term exposure investigation. He concluded by saying, "These findings provide evidence for long-term durability and tolerability of ozanimod treatment in patients with moderate to severely active UC." We know that exposure to proton pump inhibitors, PPIs, is an independent risk factor for worse treatment outcomes and shorter survival. This is really an ongoing debate and regarding the impact of PPIs on the evolution of inflammatory bowel disease, or IBD. Previous work has shown that the gut microbiome in PPI users and patients with IBD have certain common characteristics, such as decreased diversity and abundance of potentially pathogenic species, suggesting that PPI use might be associated with IBD. To shed light on this issue, Dr. Stéphanie Barrault from the Saint-Étienne University Hospital in France and her coworkers performed a single-center retrospective cohort study, and they included consecutive adult patients diagnosed with Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis. All patients were followed prospectively for over a four-month period, and PPI use was defined as a PPI exposure for a duration of more than 7 days after IBD diagnosis until the end of follow-up. In this time period, the authors assessed a possible association of PPI exposure with treatment failure defined as an IBD-related surgery or hospitalization and/or failure of more than 4 different biologic treatments, including TNF blockers, vedolizumab, ustekinumab, and so forth. Included in this particular analysis were 244 patients, of which 113 had been previously exposed to a PPI. In total, 152 patients encountered treatment failure. PPI use could be identified as an independent factor associated with treatment failure with a significant p-value. In a subgroup analysis by IBD type, this association remained only significant for Crohn's disease, but not for ulcerative colitis. PPI use was not associated with the risk of immunogenicity in the subgroup of patients treated with infliximab. Importantly, survival without treatment failure was significantly longer in patients who were not exposed to PPIs, compared with those with PPI exposure, and that was 325 months versus 228 months, significant p-value. Therefore, the authors actually suggest that the use of PPIs in patients with Crohn's disease should be discussed on a case-by-case basis. Offspring of patients with Crohn's disease have a 6-to-8-fold risk of incident Crohn's disease compared with the general population. In particular, pregnancy and the first year postpartum seems to be critical for the development and maturation of both the gut microbiome as well as the immune responses. Therefore, Dr. Sun-Ho Lee from Mount Sinai Hospital in Canada and his team tried to explore whether exposure to parental Crohn's disease diagnosis during this vulnerable period compared with exposure later in life is associated with an increased risk of Crohn's disease. In particular, they assessed whether early life exposure to a parent's Crohn's disease diagnosis impacts the offspring's gut inflammation markers, intestinal permeability, and the gut microbiome. And the researchers analyzed data of 1,252 offsprings of patients with a Crohn's disease who were recruited in the Crohn's Colitis Canada GEM project. It's a large prospective cohort study following healthy first-degree relatives of patients with Crohn's disease to identify genetic, environmental, and microbial determinants of Crohn's disease. Dr. Lee explained, quote, "We specifically concentrated on the offspring cohort and looked at when patients had their Crohn's disease diagnosis. Therefore, they classified offspring into, quote, perinatally exposed, end quote, or, quote, exposed later in life, end quote, to parental Crohn's disease diagnosis. Finally, 586 patients with a parental Crohn's disease diagnosis in the perinatal period, during pregnancy and the first year postpartum, could be identified and were compared with offspring who had parents with a Crohn's disease diagnosis after the perinatal period, and that's 666. The only difference between the cohorts was the country of recruitment. After a five-time period, 2% of the early exposure cohort, compared to only 0.5% of the late cohort, had a diagnosis of Crohn's disease. This translated into a hazard ratio of 4.73. So that's a 4.7-fold risk, even after adjustment for age. Dr. Lee said, quote, "You see a dose effect regarding the exposure to mother's Crohn's disease diagnosis, and the earlier you're exposed, the higher seems to be the effect size," end quote. Exposure to a mother's Crohn's disease diagnosis more than a year before birth was associated with a hazard ratio of 6.3. This effect was not seen with fathers. Patients with an exposure to a parent's CD diagnosis, Crohn's disease diagnosis, during the perinatal period had an increase in intestinal permeability and altered fecal bacterial composition. The authors concluded that the environmental exposure to a parent with Crohn's disease during the perinatal period may have a lingering impact on offspring's gut barrier function and gut microbiome development, and thus elevates the risk of Crohn's disease development. Dr. Heidi Sjogard Christensen from Aalborg University Hospital in Denmark presented real-world data on the potential risk of GLP, or glucagon-like peptide 1-based therapies. She talked about a prospective nationwide cohort study looking at the risk of development of inflammatory bowel disease linked to the treatment of type 2 diabetes with a class of drugs called glucagon-like peptide 1-based therapies. The study compared the exposure with GLP-1 receptor agonists and DPP-4 inhibitors with other glucose-lowering agents by using data from the Danish Patient Prescription and Civil Registration Registries between 2007 and 2018. The cohort over those 11 years included 177,950 patients with a new prescription of glucose-lowering medications, and the median time of follow-up was 4.8 years. The median age of the adult patients at the start of the study was 63 years, and a total of 412 cases of incident IBD were observed in that period of time. Overall, treatment with one of the GLP-1-based therapies did not show an increased risk of developing IBD with a statistically non-significant hazard ratio of 0.96 in comparison with the other diabetes drugs. Distinguishing between GLP-1 receptor agonists and DPP-4 inhibitors also did not uncover significantly different IBD risks with a hazard ratio of 1.3 and 0.84 respectively. Dr. Christensen recapped that overall no evidence of a risk of IBD following the use of GLP-1-based therapy was detected, but she also added, quote, "But I think that the influence of GLP-1 receptor agonists may need further investigation to completely rule out a negative association," she concluded. There was a presentation about the four-year results of the UNIFI long-term extension study looking at ustekinumab and its safety and efficacy over the whole time period in patients with moderate to severe ulcerative colitis, or UCI. The interleukin-12/23p40 antagonist ustekinumab is already approved for the treatment of moderate to severe ulcerative colitis. Professor Silvio Tenese from the Vita Salute San Raffaele University and the IRCCS San Raffaele Hospital in Italy presented the final clinical outcomes based on the full Mayo score, including the endoscopy subscore from the UNIFI LTE study through 4 years of ustekinumab treatment. 523 patients who responded to therapy with ustekinumab at 8 weeks after intravenous induction were re-randomized to the maintenance study. In this study, they were treated either with 90 milligrams ustekinumab every 8 weeks or every 12 weeks. 284 patients completed week 44 and entered the long-term extension until week 200. From week 56 onwards, dose adjustments were possible at any time based on the clinical judgment of the investigator. In the analysis, all patients at the long-term extension were included that either had Mayo score data including endoscopy at week 200 or experienced treatment failure before week 200, so imputed as a non-responder. At week 200, 58% of the patients were in clinical remission, defined as a Mayo score of less than or equal to 2 points and no individual subscore greater than 1. Overall, there were very similar results for the 12-week and 8-week dose intervals, said Professor Denise. 80% of the patients showed a clinical response defined as a decrease in Mayo score of greater than or equal to 30% and greater than or equal to 3 points from induction baseline with either a decrease in rectal bleeding subscore of greater or equal than 1 from induction baseline or a rectal bleeding subscore of 0 or 1. In addition, 67% achieved endoscopic improvement with an endoscopy subscore of 0 or 1. And again, there were no major differences according to the dose intervals. Professor Danese commented, saying, around 30% of patients need a shorter dose interval. In conclusion, the UNIFI LTE study showed that approximately 2/3 of patients with moderate to severe ulcerative colitis treated with ustekinumab were in clinical remission, clinical response, and or demonstrated endoscopic improvement after 4 years. According to Professor Danese, it is unique to include endoscopy in a study over such a long period. That's all the time we have for today's podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe and stay healthy.
This podcast was produced by Medicom Medical Publishers.